Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love, coming to you wherever you may be. Welcome to our latest Book Reporter Talks To interview with our guest, Jane Green. We are going to be talking about her latest novel, Sister Stardust. Now, Jane and I had a really fun chat about this book a couple of weeks ago at an industry event. And it was one-on-one. We were on this little room, like sitting along chatting virtually, of course. And I just said, oh my gosh, now I've got to read this book. And as soon as I read it, I was like, oh my gosh, I've got to bring it to our readers. Because here's what I'm going to do. It's atmospheric. Sister Stardust is going to get you back in the 60s in Morocco. And you're going to get there in about 2 seconds, like as you start reading this book. It's those hedonistic days. We're going to go into, let's just say sex, drugs, and rock and roll. We're definitely going to be there. It's a Book Reporter Bets On selection. I'm selecting it for setting, character, and story because they all flow completely together. So welcome, Jane. So nice to have you here.
Oh, Carol, it's wonderful to be here. Thank you for having me.
And I've dressed. I'm here we go. The hedonistic 60s. I'm ready to go. Here we go. So start out, tell us about Sister Stardust. Tell us about this book I'm crazy about.
So Sister Stardust was inspired by a photograph that I saw when I was probably a teenager growing up in London of this spectacularly beautiful woman who was sort of almost in a semi-crouch with one leg extended on a rooftop in Marrakesh wearing this exquisitely embroidered Moroccan wedding caftan. And behind her was a man in a hooded robe looking quite mysterious. And I was instantly transfixed. I discovered that her name was Talita Getty. She was married to Paul Getty Jr., who was the son of the richest man in the world. And together they bought this dilapidated palace in Marrakesh and renovated it. And because it was the 60s and counterculture and everybody in Europe was doing the North African hippie trail, everybody stopped off at the Gettys. So they actually threw a New Year's Eve party in 1967. And there's somebody, I can't remember whose diary it was. It wasn't Paul, but it was John Hopkins in his Tangier diary said that Paul McCartney and John Lennon were so stoned they couldn't get off their backs from the floor all night. They just lay on their backs. And they were known for throwing these unbelievably decadent wild parties. Anyone who was anyone was there. Gore Vidal, Jane Fonda, William S. Burroughs, the Rolling Stones. They were great friends. Mick Jagger and Marianne Faithfull were there all the time. And so I created my protagonist, this little country mouse, Claire, and she gets swept off to Marrakesh by a rock band who are actually completely inspired by the Rolling Stones, but specifically there was a love triangle between Brian Jones, who was the founder of the Rolling Stones, and his girlfriend Anita Pallenberg and Keith Richards. And I really drew from that for this storyline. But my sweet Claire, who is renamed Cece because it's more glamorous, she goes off to Marrakesh. It all looks heavenly, but of course, behind closed doors. And by the way, this is all true. I mean, Claire is not true, but Talita Getty is true, the Rolling Stones. And behind closed doors, while Vogue was writing about Mrs. Getty and her glamorous souk chic, and she was a muse of Yves Saint Laurent, but they were also quietly diving into, first of all, opium addiction and eventually heroin addiction. And she ended up dying a very early and tragic death with some mysterious circumstances around it. And I've just sort of been obsessed with her my whole adult life. But I didn't know very much about her. So this gave me an opportunity to do a very deep dive. And I loved every second of it.
Yeah, well, we could tell. It comes across on the pages that you loved her as a person, though you saw every side of her. And we'll get into that as well. But you didn't see just the fun loving, come follow me wherever I go.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that you loved her for that long a time. Because I think when you do, the idea of that person kind of marinates in your head.
Yeah.
And it's like, how would I portray her? What would I do with her? How could I pull her together? She's so charismatic. She's one of these charismatic people that follow. Was that something that you saw as you were researching about her? Because I know you did a lot of reading for this.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose I must have somehow sensed it just from looking at the photographs, because there was something so compelling for me. I mean, I still do. I mean, every time I look at photographs of her, I just feel myself being drawn in. But there was much that I discovered that I didn't know, that I hadn't known. And, you know, she was actually born in Java. It was part mm-hmm. of the Dutch East Indies. And when the mm-hmm. Japanese invaded, they threw her family into prison camps and she was tortured. So she covered up. She was tremendously beautiful, very exotic looking, with these sort of wide spaced almond shaped eyes. And everybody who knew her described her as just as being an enchantress. Mm-hmm. She was so vivacious and fun and always laughing with this and free. Of course, it was the 60s, and you know, we suddenly had the pill for the first time, and Britain had its own music. We had the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. But even in the free love culture of the 60s, Talita was particularly free. Mm-hmm. And there's something about her spirit that I think has survived. I mean, I've brought her back to life in this novel, mm-hmm. but actually if you look at fashion for the last 50 years, so many huge designers have cited Talita Getty as their muse. So she continues mm-hmm. to inspire. So even without knowing that much about her, I think the photographs, it comes across.
Mm-hmm. I feel like she was really curious about life. She wanted to live it as big as she could. She wanted to go to the markets. She wanted to go to the places you weren't supposed to go, just to go experience. And if she went into a place, it wasn't just to visit, it was to do a deep dive. Whether it was in London, wherever she was, it was, I'm part of this place with my tribe around me. And was also yeah. with a tribe, always with a tribe of people. Yes. And I think the hedonistic lifestyle, I was trying to figure out what drew her to it. My theory is the way she grew up, like, you know, in so much hardship. Do you yeah. feel the same way? Do you think that's from what you saw?
I do. I actually think, I know that towards the end of her life, when she and her husband separated and he was living with his mistress in Rome, and he bought her as a wedding present this wonderful house in Cheyne Walk in Chelsea in London, called, it was known as the Rossetti House. It's where the artist Rossetti lived in the late 19th century. So lots of kind of drama and intrigue and drugs actually in that house as well. And Paul Getty was fascinated by the Pre-Raphaelites, and so he bought that house for her. And she was very depressed. She was having thyroid problems, which actually, like, you can see in a lot of her photographs, you can see the hint of a goiter. You can see that it didn't surprise. I mean, I could see that. I wondered whether she had thyroid problems, and then read somewhere that she had. And she was terribly depressed. And actually, I think that her life was very much a roller coaster, and the trauma. I mean, look, today we go and see therapists, or there are so many ways to help. But then I think she self-medicated with alcohol primarily, mm-hmm. actually. Some drugs, although I think drugs were not her primary addiction. And parties, people. I think as long as she kept running, as long as she was surrounded by people, she was running from herself, and mm-hmm. ultimately I think she couldn't.
Yeah, and it was like the extrovert part of her. The extrovert part of her kept her going. Yeah. Let's have people over. Let's do this. I actually love the part where Paul just came out and goes, "Who are all these people? Just go. You're freeloading." It was such yeah. a great line of leave. Just go yeah. now. Yeah.
And it happened. I mean, Paul was very extroverted when he was young. His mother, Anne Rourke, was, he was brought up in San Francisco, and she was a wonderful socialite, very extroverted. All his friends would come to their house to drink and party. But as he got older, he became more and more introverted. And actually, I think that was a terrible mismatch. I think they truly did love each other, but I also think that he just couldn't keep up with her pace, and he mm-hmm. didn't want to.
Mm-hmm. And he didn't want to. But he enjoyed other things. He enjoyed classical music. Yeah. He enjoyed just sitting and reading. And that was not her thing. It was just yes. to go.
Yes, opera and bookbinding was a passion of his. Yeah.
So now, have you spent time in Morocco? Have you been?
I have, yes. And I'm desperate to go back. I was actually in London 2 weeks ago, and I really thought, oh, I wonder if I can, because now that they've opened up Morocco, because it was closed for a long time because of the pandemic, I thought, could I just scoot over there for a couple of days? And then I thought, you know, that's really, if I'm going to go, I need to go with my husband preferably, or a girlfriend, or it's, what am I going to do in Morocco by myself? I mean, I do have a couple of friends there, but I just like the same thing.
You know, you captured the whole scene, not just the getting home, which sounds fabulous, but the bazaars and everything. And I have a friend who just got back and she's got all these pictures. And I was looking at her pictures on Facebook against what you wrote. And it was just, you really brought it to life, because when I saw her pictures, I was like, oh, I know what that bazaar would be like. Oh, I know where those spices would be. I know. And just the colors and everything, it felt like it was sun-kissed, but also just vivid color all over the place. Like, seriously, I was thinking, you've got to wear something bright today, because yeah, it's exactly the way you feel reading the book. Picture people sitting on the book all summer reading this book, and just like bright color against the sun.
I hope so. It's the first time I've ever written this kind of fiction, you know, whether you call it biographical fiction or historical fiction, but I couldn't start writing it until I felt that I was there. And I know Morocco, but I don't, and I was born in the 60s, but I don't know the 60s, you know. And I all of that reading I did, I really, by the time I actually sat down and started writing, I felt like I was there. I felt like I lived that alongside Claire and Talita on every page.
Mm-hmm. And it definitely comes across. It's not a moment where you don't feel like you're completely immersed in the culture. You know, you also brought up something really interesting in the book that we think about, but we don't think about because we were here in the States. And it was about Britain taking such a long time to recover after the war, and how hard it was to come back. And it was a very bleak time. Yeah. And all of a sudden there was music coming out of America. It was Motown. It was whatever was coming out of the States. And then it was the British invasion, and it was the Stones, and it was the Beatles. And then all of a sudden, I feel like Britain came back into its own. Like it came back to something that was ever to do. And it's the coolest music was then happening and all that kind of stuff. So let's talk about that, because I think that I often forget about that part. And I think, like, these days when I'm watching pictures of Ukraine, where these whole cities are bombed out, and you're getting a visual of bombed out London, having to come back, but there are people that are going through a really hard time as the city is rebuilding.
Yeah, it took years. If you think back to the Second World War, and we were, you know, London was, parts of London were completely decimated. I mean, there were bomb sites everywhere, because they would drop the doodle bugs. So the bombs would drop in a line. So what you'd have is a line of streets, and in the same place, like, the houses would be destroyed. And there was no money, and people lived on, you know, rations for years afterwards. And Britain was just depressed and grey and sad. And, you know, all of a sudden we got into the 60s, and I think Britain then won the FA Cup final, Britain won the World Cup, actually, which is huge in football, or as you say over here, soccer. I say football still, so we won the World Cup. And then out of nowhere, you know, having listened to sort of Motown and blues from America, if you wanted to listen to contemporary music, suddenly the Beatles appeared and the Rolling Stones, and we had our own music for the first, there'd never been pop stars before, never been rock stars. It just hadn't existed. And all of a sudden Britain just came alive, and people had money, and young women went out to work, and they had disposable income. And there was a show on, I'm not sure, I think it may have been, it's in the book, I don't remember when it was on, but called Ready, Steady, Go.
Yes.
And it was, you know, it was every, they'd have all the bands on every week, and the audience would be dancing. And every week people would study what the host wore, and then they'd go to Carnaby Street and buy what she wore as close as they could get. And it just, you know, London came alive. And also, of course, then as the 60s progressed, we had the psychedelic drugs, you know, thanks to Timothy Leary over at Harvard doing all of his research into psychedelic drugs. And of course, they came over to England. And suddenly, you know, you look at, I found myself staring at Sgt. Pepper, at the album cover the other day, and I was thinking, wonder if they deliberately made it like that for people who were on psychedelic trips. And all of the art, actually, if you look at all of the art, that it was all because everybody was tripping. And then with the pill, in England, the pill was introduced to married women in 1963, and it was introduced to everybody in 1967. So suddenly, what had been a conjugal duty, sex was not about pleasure. Sex was, we have a phrase, you lie back, close your eyes, and think of England. And you know, you were doing your duty to bear children for your husband, but all of a sudden, sex became, you know, and it became almost too commonplace. You know, people, a lot of women actually have spoke out latterly, saying they actually felt that they couldn't say no because they'd be deemed kind of non-groovy and not part of the flow. So they actually felt that they had to. And for others, it was a source of enormous pleasure. But it was just very different. It was, everything burst into color.
And it's also, it was small enough that if you went out at night, you could see the Rolling Stones. You could see people, not the band would be in the audience, or the band might jump up on the stage and do something. It was a very small place. It's not like America, where it'd be even New York and the Village, not same thing. It was all like, you know, just encapsulated in this one place. And it was the day that it could be a hangout or go to a big club. It could be this or that. And I just love the contrast of what was going back and forth that you really brought out to light. You know, also I love up front, you have an epigraph that's from The Secret Language of Birthdays. And I have to tell you, I have this book. And I was like, wait a second, this is what she did. When you gave some background about October 18th, 1940. So I had that book for two decades. What made you decide to do that? It's with this birthday, but what made you decide to do that and put that? Because it was just so spot on of sort of the astrological way you might have been thinking about her.
Well, and by the way, something I discovered that was really interesting is everybody was obsessed with astrology in the 60s. Everybody would, it was all like, hey man, you know, what sign are you? Everybody wanted to know what stars, and everybody was obsessed. But and everybody was going to psychics as well. Talita refused to go. She never ever went. And I do wonder whether she somehow had a sense that she might hear something she didn't want to if she went, because I find it just so fascinating that all of those in her circle were going and she would not, she refused. So I love that book, that birthday book. And I just, reading about myself years ago, found it spookily accurate. And while I was writing it, I just remember thinking, oh, I wonder how they describe her. And it seemed to be so, so Talita. And so I decided to put that in.
Yeah, and marrying that with the quote from Yves Saint Laurent was just like perfect, because it was the two juxtapositions. It's how she came and who she became, because he was dressing her. And it was the kind of thing where I just loved where they'd say, well, no, you don't have to buy it. He's just going to send me clothes. Like if you get a stain on it, don't worry about it. He'll just send me more. Because these women, I spent 17 years at Condé Nast, so I knew the fashion business, and there are people, they love to dress. Like the designers just wanted you to be wearing their clothes and see how you looked and wore in them. And I felt like she was their muse in a lot of ways, but she was also, that's how it's supposed to look. That's how it's supposed to go. And they would go style her. They'd say, oh no, move this over a little bit more, or.
Yeah. And she would, you know, take, she was a muse for Yves Saint Laurent. And so she'd be wearing some fabulous couture thing with some, you know, local Marrakesh robe on top. She was always in robes and caftans and scarves and silks, and so she would make everything more exotic. Whatever it was that she put on, she added her own spin
and thing. So Claire gets there. So okay, let's back up. The narrator is this naive young girl from a small town, small part, and she's totally drawn into this world. What was your reason to have a Claire narrating the story, an outsider doing it?
Well, I didn't ever feel confident enough to tell the story from Talita's perspective, and also because her son is alive. Mm-hmm. You know, there are people around, some of whom I was lucky enough to talk to, but there are people around who knew her, who loved her, and I wanted to be very careful with and respectful of how I wrote about her. But also I always loved, you know, the sort of Gatsby-esque thing of having a narrator who's standing slightly on the outside observing and, you know, in this case does get drawn in, but is able to sort of see things with a perspective that perhaps they can't, those who are in it cannot quite see, even though they recognize that she's sensible. And Paul actually in the book says to Cece, you know, look after her, be her friend. And Paul Getty in real life said that to a number of women. He knew that she needed a stable influence. He wanted her to have a stable influence. And he asked women that he trusted to look after her.
And she wasn't going to just listen to him. She'd have to listen to somebody who, like, he was there, but he was also listening to opera and he was listening to classical music. And she was,
And he was a drug addict. I mean, he was at the height of his addiction. So he wasn't really capable of doing anything. And I think that was the deep trauma that he then had to live with, that he felt culpable somehow in her death, because I don't know where the heroin came from. I imagine it may have come from him, but even if it didn't, she took the overdose. And when he looked in, there were people around all night. When he looked in, he thought she was sleeping. And that went on for hours when he thought she was sleeping and she was dying.
And it's because he was so wrapped up in what he was doing. It's like, oh, this is, everybody can survive. Doing the amount of drugs I did, everybody else can do it. And it wasn't really what was going on.
Yeah.
So Claire becomes Cece, and with this small change of name, she shreds who she was. Like, she just takes it away. She gets swept up and she seems to have no fear. And it's like suddenly the small town girl can embrace life. She's been in this place where nobody was doing it. Was that what you were looking for in a character? Was somebody that could go from here to here and just go, wham, this is me?
Well, I wanted her to just slowly fall under the spell, because it was just the Arabian Nights. I mean, it was extraordinary how they lived. They would regularly have 30 people to lunch, or 30 people for dinner on the roof, and all of a sudden all the houseboys would be taking everything up there, or they'd decide to have a picnic in the Atlas Mountains and they'd all trek out there, and the houseboys would be carrying trays of onion tarts and all this craziness. And when Cece first sees there and sees how these parties often devolved into these kind of orgiastic affairs, she's frightened of it. She's not ready. This isn't what she wants. This isn't what she'd anticipated. But as she slowly falls under Talisha's spell, it reaches a point where there's nothing she won't do for her. And it really is, I mean, she falls in love with her, actually.
Yeah, she casts the spell on the people that are around her, and you just fall into there. You know, I guess one of the questions I was thinking of for book groups, because it'd be a fun book group book, especially over the summers. How honest can Claire be as a narrator? Because she's still trying to see it. She's older now as she's writing this and she's looking back. Could she have been that honest when she was younger, or she sort of at the time of her life? I think that's my book club question to toss out there is, could she have written this before, or was she so swept up in it that she couldn't have taken that step back and said, what were we doing then?
I think that she would definitely have a much more open-minded approach. I think as we get older, we become much more accepting, and things that maybe seemed shocking when we were young, just sort of par for the course. I also think that it was guilt that kept her from revisiting those times, because, well, I won't give it away, but I think she carried tremendous guilt. I mean, I think in my book, she carried the guilt, just a sliver of the guilt that I think Paul Getty Jr. in real life carried with him for the rest of his life. Yeah. And my Cece has a little of that.
Yeah. So let's talk about the Riads. Riads, is that correct?
Yeah.
Where the wealthy people lived. Because I love to hear you describe them, because they were really these rundown places, and then they made them into sort of palaces. Yes.
Well, they were. So part of the Islamic religion is to not display wealth. I mean, it is not, you are supposed to keep your wealth private. And so in these Muslim countries, often the homes, and in Morocco, the homes are all hidden behind walls. So you can be walking down like a little narrow cobbled alley. There's usually a few stray cats, and there are just these wooden doors that look like nothing in a wall, and you think it's nothing. And you step through these doors into a paradise, these tiled courtyards. And the traditional tile in Morocco is this deep green tile, and the courtyards always have a fountain in the middle, and so everything happens in the court and around. It's built around the courtyard, and so the women are able to then dress freely. They don't have to be covered up because it's just their family in these homes, and many of the grand ones are linked. It's a series of riads linked together, so they can have numerous courtyards. And I think Le Palais des Zahir, which is the they all called it Sidi Mamoun, which is after the area in which it sits in Marrakesh. I believe it's four courtyards in that, and gardens and just magnificent. And they had peacocks actually at the time, which I think Paul Getty hated because of the peacock poop. But just, and giant, you know, palms and jacaranda blossoms, which are this lovely lilac just scattering on the deep green tile. And then they burn fires at night, and the houseboys would light these fires with sandalwood and just extraordinary smells. And that's the thing. I mean, Morocco is just a feast for the senses. Everything, mm-hmm. everything just feels, smells, tastes richer and deeper and brighter.
And that's what really came across in the book. Like, I felt like I was there. I felt like I could see the gardens. And then beyond that, I feel like I could taste the food. When you lay the foods out on the table and explained how everything was going to be there, I felt like it was this sumptuous banquet that was laid before us to sit and just relish and enjoy. And I was like, okay, now what am I going to eat for lunch? Oh, let's see, more crackers with peanut butter. You know what I mean? Because yeah. I'll run downstairs and just go get that.
Yeah.
So it's, in your research, it seems like everybody was sort of in awe of her, though. I mean, they just wanted to sit there and look at Talitha and go, oh, look at this beautiful woman, blah, blah, blah. But by the same token, I think you did such a good job of portraying the other side of the whole group, because everybody would come to Sisi and kind of confide and tell her, it's like she was part of their world, but she hadn't been there that long. So they feel like there was like this moment of realness about her as well, that they could come over and say how they felt.
Yeah, they refer to her as an innocent, and there's something about that they absolutely cherish. I mean, yes, I think they know that she will inevitably be pulled in, and yet they so cherish having somebody there who can witness it, love them, and not get caught up in it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there's this cornucopia of drugs on every single day that's like insane. And of course, we have the drug dealer coming on the candy man coming on any single day. And it was something about tuning out the way that things had been. And I feel like trying to see the world through new eyes. That's what I was seeing that the people were trying to do still. Like that moment of it's old Britain, new Britain. Let's go in with colors and lights and new feelings.
Yeah. And I think also, you know, the whole thing with drugs, and I you know, go back to that idea of self-medicating with drugs. And also, I think when the world is really terrifying, sometimes we look to alter our realities a bit. And I think it's happening again now. I think there are actually a lot of parallels. We have the race wars, we have war. We are in probably the most frightening place we've been in decades. And I also see, and it's not quite a counterculture because there isn't one culture anymore, you know, especially in America, it's so divided. And and yet there is this movement of spirituality, and drugs are coming back in vogue in a different kind of way. But we see, you know, marijuana being legalized everywhere. Mm-hmm. And now more and more scientific studies are proving that the use of psilocybin, which is the compound found in hallucinogenic mushrooms and drugs, can be incredibly effective at curing anxiety and depression. And so I understand, I think that there are a lot of parallels between the 60s and now.
And it's also, we also see the what's happening with fentanyl, that you find that there are kids that are buying drugs on TikTok or by somebody they meet on TikTok or somebody they meet on Instagram. So our worlds have changed. It's not just you go into the city to some place to go do this. You can do this anywhere at this point. Yeah. And people can reach you in any place. And the number of people that, oh, this is cocaine, but it's laced with fentanyl, and now you're dead. And now it's, you know, just what has ended up happening in it's, and there are parallels to before of with heroin, and there's bad batches and things like that where we're going on as well.
Well, by the way, I mean, look, the 27 Club. I mean, there so many in the 70s, so many people were lost to drugs at such a, you know, whether Jimi Hendrix, you know, I mean, just I could go on forever, Janis Joplin and Jim Morrison, and then of course latterly Amy Winehouse, but again, you know, when you have those kinds of drugs, you have those kinds of deaths, those tragic, senseless early deaths, and Talita is one of them.
And you also reference Mick Jagger as being the smart, cool stone, and it's very interesting because they said that he partied, but he still kept his wits about him. And I've heard this about him for years. And did that surprise you during your research?
Well, the whole thing surprised me, actually, because I didn't really know anything about the Stones. I wasn't particularly interested. And actually, ironically, Keith Richards lives about 8 minutes away from my house. I've never seen him. Although 3 years ago, had I passed him in the street, I would have just been like, oh, it's Keith Richards, big deal. Today, I think my heart might stop, because part of my research into this book involved this huge dive into the Rolling Stones, and I hadn't realized how intertwined their lives were with Morocco in the 60s. I mean, Morocco was really a safe harbor for them. They were great friends with the Geshes, particularly Mick and Marianne. But I was fascinated by all of them, and Keith in particular. And I've not only read, I've watched so many interviews and films and documentaries and footage, and I have friends who know Mick Jagger, actually. I do know people who know him, and he is clearly impossibly charming. But Keith, I love Keith. Keith's my guy. A musician's musician, really. His love is the music. He doesn't care about the high life or any of that stuff, whereas Mick, I think, was much more, he really liked mixing with the aristocracy, which was the other interesting thing, by the way, about the 60s. Class is so, it's so rigid in the UK, and you would never mix classes, you know, the whole upstairs, downstairs thing. It doesn't matter how much money you make, you can never transcend the class into which you're born. And suddenly, in the 60s, these like Cockney Barrow boys, like David Bailey, were becoming the most celebrated photographers and artists. And so it became a meritocracy. And actually all of the aristocracy, who would never have rubbed shoulders with the working classes before, suddenly they wanted to be best friends with Mick Jagger. They and John Lennon, they all wanted to be friends. And so I love how all of that class stuff sort of went out the window in the 60s.
Mm-hmm. And it carries right through to Diana and Elton John. I mean, you think about all the years like going forward of exactly what would end up happening. You know, it's like Jagger went to the London School of Economics, and they've often said he'd be drinking water. He wouldn't be drinking. He would not be doing what you think he'd do. He'd go home. And when there was some YouTube thing I found a couple of weeks ago, video of his exercise routine and what he does. And I thought, my God, to be in your 70s and jumping around like that on stage and every night doing that for nights on end, it's, you've got to be in fantastic shape.
And the amount of discipline and control that requires is extraordinary. And I think that is Mick. Mick is very, he's just very controlled and very disciplined. Whereas Keith is like, Keith's just, you know, playing my guitar, me and Patty hanging out. I'd be friends with Keith.
You'd be friends with Keith. Well, you know, it's funny because I always say that everybody's got to go see the Rolling Stones at least one time. And my son got one ticket a couple of years ago and went, and I said, you just have to go. And I went and I had like the nosebleed seats at the Garden, but I can still remember when everything opened like this on the stage, because it's theater at the same time as its performance. And it's a lot of what Talitha and was trying to put together at their home. It was theater. It was big. It was a show. Yes. Every single night. And I could just picture her walking into the kitchen and saying, the food, this is what we're going to do. And this is how we're going to do it. And it's not like they were making it up. She was making it up. Yeah. I had this great thing, go do this. And you just saw the upstairs, downstairs there would be so interesting in Morocco. I'm sure when they left, the people were like, okay, now I need a month of rest, you know, just because
what crazy thing
are they going to do tonight?
Yeah, their house manager actually said her most favorite time was when they weren't there, because the house was quiet and empty. Mm-hmm. And she gave all of the staff tons of downtime because it was so frenetic and crazy when they were there.
And it'd be crazy till 4 a.m. and then there'd be breakfast and then there'd be this and that. You know, she died when she was 30. I went and did like some little deep dive and research there. So young to have died. And I wonder what happened to her if drugs didn't take her. I would wonder, like, okay, she would be 81 at this point. I did that math too. And you think about these people who were at that point in their lives, a lot did not survive. I mean, let's just get real. There were a lot of people did overdose or terrible things happened to them along the way, accidents, you know, things like that. But you just sort of wonder her at 81 right now, what she would have been like and how her spirit, was she being harnessed, you know?
Yeah, I can't imagine her old. It's almost a bit like Princess Diana. I think sometimes these women who are terrifically damaged and carry that trauma with them, I can't imagine how they would have continued to live, which may sound like a really morose thing to say, but there's almost an inevitability about it.
Mm-hmm. Because it's like, okay, well, what happens then? Well, she did have a child. She did have a child with him after the period of time during this book. She had 3 stepsons during the time frame of this book. And it's not in the pages that we write here, but did you, in your research, did you learn about her time, like becoming a mother, what it was like for her in any of the research you did?
Yeah, I think it was a little overwhelming, actually. Mm-hmm. I don't think she really knew how to be a mother. She had an Italian family living with her in Cheney Walk, and certainly some of the interviews I've read, she seemed to be a little overwhelmed. I don't doubt that she adored her son. Mm-hmm. And I think you can see it in the photographs. You can see that she loved him. But I also think she was on her own. This wasn't the life that she had planned. Her husband wasn't with her. And I think actually, whether it was depression caused by her thyroid issues or whether it was just depression, I don't think she was as present as she might have been. And it was at a time in England. I actually share his birthday and year of birth. We were born on the same day. And English parenting in that time was very, very different to American parenting. I mean, children really were to be seen and not hurt. You know, it was delightful to have you around if you were on your best behavior and beautifully dressed, but otherwise you'd be sent off with the nanny.
Mm. So it was always like, okay, here, gone. So yeah, And was she brought up in that kind of environment as well after the time? Was she?
So her first few years were in the prison camp. Then, you know, her mother died shortly after. She was very close with her stepmother. Mm-hmm. Her father remarried after three years, and she was very close with her stepmother. But I don't know, actually. There's very little about her relationship with them. She looks happy. Her stepmother, Poppet Poll, she became Poppet Poll. She was Poppet John. And she was the daughter of a very famous British artist called Augustus John. And there are wonderful pictures of Talita as a young girl, you know, with Augustus, who was sort of bearded and larger than life, and they look like they adore each other.
Yeah. So the seen, not heard, there you go, you know, yeah. move on. You know, there's this wonderful line where Benji, who's another character in the book, talks about vacations and how magical they are, but then they end and you go back to your real life. Staying on vacation means they turn into something else. And it's such a great line because we've always been at places that we loved and we long to stay at longer. Yeah. But there's that moment where you need to leave. You need to go or you're going to stay. And I've been in ski towns where people stayed. And did you make it or not? I mean, I've from some friends have been marvelously successful, but some of them, it's just like this grind life from there.
Yeah.
I love that line. It was so like, you've got to go. If you stay, it's not going to always be like this.
Yeah, it's so true. You know, my kids are learning the hard way. My son took a gap year and decided to spend it living and working in Jackson Hole, you know, mm-hmm. because he loves it. And he's a ski bum and he's supporting himself. He has two jobs. And you know what? It is brutal. I mean, he is lonely and isolated. And it's been really, it was not at all what he thought it would be.
Yeah, with people come, people go. People come out there, they have money, then they don't have money, they lose their job, they don't like their job driving the shuttle bus for the ski resort, like whatever it is. And then they leave, and then all new visitors come every week, but they're on vacation and you're not. And it's, you can go out to the bars, but there's some exotic thing about the people who live there though. Like you always, if you go into a town, you want to know the people who live there all the time. Like what's it like? And I remember we spent a lot of time in Vail Beaver Creek, and there's that very high level that own those very, very, very big homes. Yeah. And then there were the guys driving the shuttle bus. They were living miles and miles and miles away.
Yeah.
Because, and it, to see that juxtaposition in each of these places. And when you realize, Cece at one point was thinking of staying and running this place, because wasn't Talita's like, oh, I think you could go run our home and you could go do this. And she's thinking this is great life. And he cautions her and says, let's pull it back. Let's pull back to reality. And I think that the reality was there. I don't think she had the same kind of reality to leave that. I don't think people were like, they didn't want her to be real. They wanted her to stay. And I think if she had said, we're not going to do this anymore, people would have been like, oh, like she wouldn't have that same aura about her.
And I think she knew that. I mean, she was terrifically insecure, which was also extraordinary to discover because here's a woman who is not only, you know, beautiful and charming and you know, spellbinding, she's also married to the son of the, I mean, she should have everything. And yet she always felt that people were only friendly with her and interested in her because she was with Paul Getty. And I think always worried that she wasn't enough on her own.
Yeah, she's not going to be doing it enough. Okay, we've got to ask. Have you made the hashish fudge recipe in the book?
Not yet, but I do actually have all the nuts and the rose water and the lavender petals downstairs. And now I have to just get myself to a dispensary to buy the marijuana to make the majoon, the cannabis fudge.
The cannabis sponge that's going to go with this. Okay, how about the cheese souffle?
Have not made that.
I've not made that. Why did you include the recipes? Because they're incredibly fun to read. I mean, I'm looking at those ingredients going, this would be fun to try.
Yeah, I love food. And food for me is, it's soul connection. It's not even about the food. It's for me, it's the way that I love the people I love. I love them through food. And I just felt that the majoon was such an intrinsic part of life in Marrakesh at that time that I had to include the recipe. My publisher actually wanted me to take it out and I just refused. And then I love that Bill Willis, who was this transplant, this Alabama boy, who was he Alabama or Kentucky, who was deeply in love with Marrakesh. He adored everything about Morocco. And yet he taught his Moroccan cook to cook his mother's southern recipes. And I just love that juxtaposition. So I had to find a quintessentially Southern cheese souffle recipe.
I tell you, I definitely want to try that. We had a plethora of egg whites a couple of weeks ago, and I was looking for things to do, and it was like the cheese souffle. Oh, yes, it would souffle. Be absolutely perfect. Yeah.
Gosh, isn't that funny? I haven't made souffle in years. I used to make it all the time, but it's so out of fashion now.
Right, right.
Although fondue is coming back.
I used to make raspberry souffles. I used to make those for dessert, and they were just fabulous. But you always had the egg whites. Then what to do? The other night we made key lime pie, like 2 weeks in a row. So we always put the egg whites in the refrigerator, swearing we're going to do something with them, and then throw them out the next week because we didn't. And yes, I really don't like a white egg omelet. I know it's supposed to be fabulous for you, but not making the cut, you know. But I think that I'm wondering what book groups are going to make, because book groups, their recipes like right in the book. I want to see which recipe they go for.
Who's going to make the majun?
There we go. We have to sit
there and see. I'll come and talk to you live.
Go to that. Now, do you do book club chats online? Do you have time to talk to readers?
I do. I'd love to. I don't get asked very often, but when I am asked, I always say yes.
Okay, terrific. So they can reach out to you on your website after they read the book?
Oh, yes. Yeah, absolutely. Or Instagram, I find... Facebook is overwhelming. I don't understand any of the inboxes, and I don't tend to see messages on there. Instagram is a really good one. You'll find me on Instagram and jane@janegreen.com. And I'd love to zoom into your book club.
There you go. So direct message, DM her, and then she'll be there and
slide into my DMs.
We've got to do this. So this is your first book of biological fiction, historical fiction. Will you want to write in the genre again? Is this something that you enjoyed?
Well, I loved it. I don't quite know how I'm going to go back. I have written a sequel novella, a short, which is actually going to be coming out on a podcast. So that will be in the fall of this year. And that takes a couple of the characters to in 1979. It pushes them forward. I love this mix of using something real that happened, particularly in the 60s and the 70s. That's just my time. It's the time that speaks to me. And then letting those characters live in my head and figuring out what happened.
Mm-hmm. Sarah McCoy's got a book coming out, set in Mystique. And I think that's that other hedonistic kind of place. The Caribbean might be a really good place to look at and see what happened there, because that's where a lot of people went. They'd go to Barbados. And a lot of Brits were going to Barbados, and they would set up homes, and it was that same kind of culture that was going down, but it was in the islands.
Yeah. My in-laws actually lived in Barbados, or my husband's grandparents lived in Barbados from England. But Mystique is really the play. I mean, Sarah McCoy's book is lovely. I blurbed it. I loved it. Yeah. But Mystique is definitely, if I were to do something in the Caribbean, that would have been, I mean, you know, it's got David Bowie, it's got Mick Jagger, it's got Colin Tennant, like Princess Margaret. Doesn't get much better than Mystique.
It's really interesting because they all go down at Christmas, but I think I told you when we were speaking at the other event, nobody talks about what's going on. You don't hear any gossip coming out of there. Yeah. And it's a very interesting place from that point of view. You don't go there to be seen, you go there to not be seen. And in a star-struck world, it's so interesting to see how everything's kept quiet. Yeah. Daniel Craig flies in, this one flies in, and there are also these little tiny planes that come in. But when we were down in the Barbados years ago, the food was fabulous. And what we found was, it was many years ago, but it was the most affordable, terrific food, like all over the island. We never hit a bad meal. And that was kind of interesting to see as well, because it's not every place. It's not every place that the food is just wonderful. And I don't know. I just like to see what you do next, because you did a deep dive of research. For those who read the book, there's a fabulous bibliography at the end of the books you read. And so there's things for more reading. And I just feel like that's what people are going to want to know. They're going to want to know more once they finish this book of what was... And it's a great way to appeal to a younger audience, I think, as well, because she's just this very cool character, and she didn't age. She never got past 30. Yeah. And that's, you know, kind of interesting.
So, also very different times. And it's very curious to see. I mean, I really do wonder how the younger generation will. I don't know whether they'll be able to relate to it. We'll see.
See, it's... I want to sit there and think about books of parallels. I want to think about how it would parallel Sally Rooney's books, how it'll parallel some of these other things, because it's for anybody who's trying to do a look at where we got to now, this is where we started to get to where we are right now and to get to the kind of writing that we've got right now and the culture that we have right now wouldn't have been started if it didn't get accelerated after the war with the counterculture and what was going on. It wouldn't. And also after coming out of the pandemic now, we're in a very interesting time because I think that people are going to assess their lives of what do they want to do. First thing was go see family. That was the first thing to do. Next thing is to travel to favorite places. Where do you go from there? What ends up happening? And I think it's going to be a very interesting time. And it's also people threw everything out. The whole basket got emptied. And now what do you put back in?
Now that is the truest thing of all. I think everybody that I'm coming across, we're all reassessing every element of our lives. You know, our friendships have changed and our work has changed. And I think it's the whole world has changed in this crazy short period of time, which can be very daunting and frightening. And also, I think if you reframe it, if you're willing to pivot, to be flexible, it can also be enormously liberating.
Well, you even think of work life. I mean, I had an office in the city for 25 years with this company. Before that, I worked in the city. I would never have thought of not going into the city. And now it's like a completely different thing. And now you think about, somebody said to me way at the beginning of the pandemic, when do you think we'll come back? When do you think the city will come back? And I said, end of 2023. And people thought I was so unoptimistic. And I said, no, actually now I think it could be later because what we need is international travel from Asia and Europe. And until that comes back to the city, yes, business people, yes, but more than that, international travel, spending big money. And until that really comes back, that's what the city is really, they're the people who live there, but then they're the people who give the city this aura about it. And there's two different cities that go on. And I think that we're going to see, what do people go back and do? You know, I don't know. I think that's something can happen. So what was the writing process like? Okay, you did all this great research. You did all this reading. You feel like you've got her. Then what happens?
I wrote in England. I went to England. We were meant to be there for a year, but we came back early because of the pandemic. But I went to England. We got this gorgeous little flat. I did the bulk of this actually at a friend's house, like a historic house on a hill in Hastings, which is by the sea. And it's perched on a hill with these spectacular views over the rooftops. Of the sort of winding old town of Hastings down to the sea. And it was magical. It was just me and my son, actually. My husband was still here. And it was really what I needed because it meant that I could, it was fully immersive. I didn't have anybody that I needed to look up. You know, my son was doing homework all day and work for school. He was doing remote school. And I just was able to tuck myself away and write. And I didn't know anybody in Hastings. So there was it wasn't punctuated by anything.
No social life. No, this is not the other thing. So, okay. Was the writing on this different because you were writing about somebody that was famous?
Easier. Lovely to have all this rich history to draw from and stories and real stories. And it just felt much less exhausting than having to make up everything, you know, having to create a whole world from scratch. This was much more fun.
Yeah. And what was the editing process like from there? Like, do you self-edit first or where do you go from there?
I self-edit and then I went through a couple of edits, but I don't think they were enormous. I don't think it was a painful edit. I don't recall rewriting chunks, which sometimes happens. But it was really sort of tightening it up.
Was the title always Sister Stardust?
No. So my working title for it was the palace, Le Palais de Zahir or du Zahir, it's known as several different things. Talita renamed it Le Palais des Plaisirs, the Pleasure Palace. And so I called it the Pleasure Palace. But then when it went out to the HarperCollins sales team, they said it sounded like an erotica novel. So my very brilliant editor came up with this title all by himself. And when he said it, I just went, oh my God, that's perfect.
Perfect.
And then a few weeks later, the cover came through and I could not believe how exquisite and beautiful that cover is. So
they captured it all. They captured it all. They really did. Really did. I felt like if you open the book and you're in the place. You're in the place like immediately and from there. About the audiobook, did you pick Fiona Hardingham to do the audio?
I did. And actually, I heard little clips of her voice. I was given the choice of four. I have read my own audiobooks for the last 10 years. I had to audition for them. They didn't want to use me. And I said, well, just let me audition. If I'm terrible, that's fine. But I did get through and I did get to read my own books, which I really enjoyed because, you know, there's a part of me that would have loved to have read this, but I also, you know, it just, there was so much going on because I'm bringing out a line of caftans and jewelry as well to go with this book, which come out, the drop is the same date. So it's just been a very busy year. And I thought there's only so much I can take on.
So let me go conquer the fashion business and the jewelry business at the same time as I'm doing a book during a pandemic. Yeah. Okay.
And I've also just partnered with somebody in a new podcast company. So, you know, not a lot going on for me.
Pivot, baby.
It's all about the pivot.
It's all about but here you go. This is what you wanted to do next. This is what you wanted to move on and do. It's something different. And you may not have done this if...
Oh, I wouldn't have done it. I mean, Sister Stardust sort of rewoke my creativity because I went to art school, but I haven't painted in years. But I found myself just endlessly painting pictures of Talita and of the characters in the book. And then that led to painting designs on fabric inspired by the caftans she wore and jewelry inspired by her. And yeah.
And you could see so many resorts where it would sell. I mean, it would absolutely sell because it's exactly what people are looking for, to do something different on vacation. Like, this is exactly what I want to go try and do. I mean, I've been on the Outer Banks and bought things that I couldn't find anyplace else. I haven't been able to find them. So that's like the Sundance catalog. That would be a good one because they do such limited things, you know? So what's next for you besides the captain, the jewelry and the podcast, a new book or not in the offing right now?
Yes, I mean, I think so. I'm torn between a couple of ideas. So I'm just, you know, what I realize is for a long time, I was writing a book a year.
Yep.
And I really love, I do like writing a book a year. I like being, it's really good for me to be out on the road and talking to people. But I also realized that I didn't love all those books equally because a lot of them were just fulfilling a contract. Not a lot of them, some of them. Some of them were books that I just felt that I had to write. And now that I've written a book that is completely from my heart, I don't really want to write another one that isn't. So I almost feel like if the next one's going to be fiction, I need to fall in love again. And I don't quite know who that will be with.
Yeah. And somewhere along that, but you have a lot going on in the meantime.
Yeah.
So what's the podcast going to be about? It's going to be,
I'm not on air. It's actually, it's a new podcast company, which has been set up by a very big guy in the podcast industry. It's called Gemini. It's Gemini 13. And it's content creation. And we're actually doing exclusive original content by authors, starting with fiction, that will be only available through the podcast. So of course there's Audible, which is wonderful. This will be free because it's a podcast. And for the author, we also have the ability to build in ads to drive sales to their new books, highly produced, so almost like those old fashioned radio plays, highly produced. You know, he has been buying a production company and digital marketing agency. His last company was Cadence 13 and he's just wonderful to work with. So my job is content.
content and figure out which content works. And, you know, it's been interesting because even watching The Gilded Age, there's a podcast with it. There's so many shows right now that go behind the scenes. Some of the shows were not my favorites, but it's still behind the scenes to listen to the writers and figure out how they put things together is fascinating. Yeah. It's why I love doing these interviews.
I wanted to do a podcast for this. I wanted to do Talita Getty. I actually do not have the time. I just can't imagine putting it. There is so much work that goes into writing, you know, a half hour podcast. I can't do it. I but if I could find somebody to do that, who knows? That maybe we'll try and get that done for the paperback.
That's what I was going to say, for the paperback would be a great time, because it's a different way to bring the book back into light and things like that. Well, this has been such a pleasure. The pleasure I knew it was going to be when I ran into you a couple of weeks ago. So thanks so much for your time.
So gorgeous spending time with you, Carol, always. I've loved our chat and the thought that you've put into all your questions. And I love that you really enjoyed this book.
I really enjoy it. I had many folded down pages I was going through yesterday going, oh, this part. How about this part? I've got to ask her, look at this, all these pages. I said, I've got to ask her about this, that, the other thing. So pleasure. I wish you so much success.
Thank you, my darling.
And with whatever you're doing next, I can't wait to keep, I'm going to be on Instagram following the caftans and everything and the jewelry. I absolutely love this. I will love this.
Carol, so take care. Thank you.
And to our readers, look forward to seeing you next time on Book Reporter Talks To. Remember, follow us on YouTube and you'll never miss an episode by subscribing or wherever you listen to podcasts. So thanks, everyone. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from Sister Stardust by Jane Green, narrated by Fiona Hardingham, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Harper Audio. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks To. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks To. Thanks to the producer of today's episode, Austin Rue. And now, hear an audiobook excerpt from Sister Stardust, narrated by Fiona Hardingham, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Harper Audio.
It wasn't until my husband was in hospital that I finally allowed myself to cast my mind back. I knew he wasn't coming home. My protector, my best friend, my rescuer. The phone would ring every day, a doctor keeping me updated. And I am thankful for that, for the compassion he showed, the unendurable shock of not being able to visit my husband, to sit with him and stroke his hands, hands that used to be so strong. Hands that could fix anything, including me. I woke up at 2:13 a.m., my dream still vibrant and alive in my head. In it, my husband was kissing my forehead, as he was always wont to do, looking into my eyes with tremendous love. It wasn't my husband as he is now, at 80, but my husband as he was when he was young. His hair, that bright ginger. His nose, covered with freckles. His grin, lighting up his face like sunshine. "You will be fine," he said. "I will always look after you." I woke up and knew he was gone. 6 months later, and I am fine, if still adjusting. I am not sentimental. I sent all his clothes off to the charity shop. What on earth would be the point in keeping those closets filled? I gathered his shirts, his ties, his beautiful suits, and took them myself. I couldn't ask Tally, my daughter would have been horrified. Since he died, I have started working again. Coiled pots and vases, some sculpture, but small, simple, not like the large ones I did 20 years ago, the ones with which I made my name. I have arthritis now, and my hands don't have the dexterity they used to. So, I keep the sculptures manageable. I take daily walks through Hampstead Village and photograph scenes that might inspire me. The windows of the little shops that line Flask Walk, the people sitting outside the Spaniards Inn, the ducks on Whitestone Pond. I come back and sketch ideas for sculptures and pots at the kitchen table. I have not been able to go into the attic to sort through the detritus of a shared life. I have not been willing to revisit the past, but my husband has been dead for 6 months. And as I sit this morning, I know that it is time. I need to move forward, I think, looking out the window, admiring the garden. The shrubs are bursting into colour as spring becomes summer, the profusion of cherry blossoms now dropping as the leaves burst into green, and the alliums and tulips start to droop, their time now over. The kitchen soothes me, with its pale grey cabinets and open shelving, white plates and bowls stacked on the shelves. There is little colour anywhere, save for cookbooks and, of course, paintings that we collected over the course of our marriage, paintings that tell the story of our lives, that cover all the walls. The television is on low as I decide to try to map out some new ideas today. I have an idea for an abstract duck sculpture, but first I will paint it and see if I can make sense of it on the page. I dip my brush into water and swirl it around the cadmium yellow on a white china plate, diluting it until it is sufficiently watery as I start to paint the outline of my duck. In the background, the murmurs from the television help me relax. I'm not really listening until the music starts, when I catch my breath and drop the paintbrush. It is Madama Butterfly, Un bel di vedremo. Maria Callas at her height. That voice. I would know that voice anywhere. Un bel di vedremo. Levasi un fil di fumo sul estremo. Con fil del mare. E po la nave appare. Po la nave bianca. Entra nel porto. Romba il suo saluto. I have heard this over the years, of course. It is the most popular aria in the opera, filled with longing and a hint of the tragedy that follows. I remember exactly where I was when I first heard it. Morocco,